This is an ABC podcast.
There's an idea that all rock stars are secretly miserable creatures, haunted by their success, terrified of their fans, unable to sustain any long-term relationships. Not so, says Dave Grohl. The life, he says, is all that it's cracked up to be and more. Dave Grohl has written a wonderful memoir that's just hit the top of the New York Times bestseller list. And it's clear from reading the book that Dave wanted that life from a very young age. He wanted the creative freedom. He wanted to see the world, to play the kind of driving, slightly twisted music that he loves. And if that meant sleeping in the van and dining on 7-Eleven food for the rest of his life, then so be it. Dave Grohl wanted to succeed in that life so much, he actually held a seance and he asked the rock and roll gods, well, one god in particular, to give it to him. And he received it in ever more intoxicating doses. The first part was touring America as the drummer for a punk band called Scream. Then there was Nirvana, which became Nirvana. And then he started his own band, the Foo Fighters, which is to this day one of the biggest bands in the world. Dave's memoir is called The Storyteller. Hello, Dave, and welcome to you, sir.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, Dave. Was this your lockdown book? Were you going stir crazy not being able to play live, and that's why you sat down to write this?
Absolutely. You are 100% correct. Basically, yeah, I'd been offered a book deal, I think maybe 10 years ago, someone approached me and asked if I would like to write a book. I knew that I would someday, but 10 years ago, I didn't necessarily feel like I had enough life in my back pocket to do that. So I waited. And last year, the Foo Fighters had just finished making a record. We had booked a world tour. It was our 25th anniversary. We were about to circle the planet celebrating in every city from, you know, Melbourne to Mississippi, and everything stopped and shut down. I was really scared of having nothing to do because I never had nothing to do. So the first thing I did was start an Instagram page, which is funny, something I'd never done before. And instead of just put up like pictures of myself in a bikini in the mirror, I thought I would just write short stories. Now, both of my parents were brilliant writers. My father was a speechwriter on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and a journalist. And my mother was a creative writing teacher. So I've always had an appreciation for written and spoken word. So I was writing for this Instagram page. And once I realized we were going to be here a while, I thought, okay, maybe now's the time. And I started writing a collection of short stories that became the book.
When you start to write stories like that, and when you write a memoir, I think there's always a moment when you realize you write something that you didn't really know was true before. And you look at it on the page and you go, holy crap, that's actually true. I didn't know that before. It sort of popped out of my head. And there it is on the page. Did you find that happen to you as you were writing this memoir?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was connecting a lot of dots. And it's one thing to sort of formulate these thoughts in your mind. It's another to sit down and write them out so that you can read them back. You get a lot more clarity in that way. And I mean, I made sort of emotional revelations while writing that they really kind of blew me away. You know, things that had to do with my childhood, things that had to do with music, the bands that I've been in, my relationships with all of these people. It was therapeutic in a funny way. You know, it really wasn't until I read the audiobook. I had to sit down and read the entire book into a microphone in 3 days. And, you know, again, it's a different experience when these words are coming out of your mouth and you're hearing your voice say these things. It was good. I mean, it was, you know, it was difficult at times, but then also like cleansing in this funny way that I'm finally able to say these things that some of them I've never said to anyone.
Do you end up forgiving your younger self in the process of writing a book like this? You look at your younger self and all of your awkwardness as you remember it. That's the stuff that you're a bit embarrassed about almost, and look at your younger self and go, you know, that wasn't such a bad kid. I actually quite like that kid after all, and all the things I was embarrassed about, I can forgive him for now. Did you have that process?
Well, I have to do that pretty much every day of my life. So, I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, I have really fond memories of my childhood. I mean, of course, some of them are difficult, but for the most part, you know, I was raised by a public school teacher, and we didn't have much money, and we lived in this tiny house, and sometimes the heat would get turned off or the electricity or the phone, things like that. But we were happy. And I was a really imaginative kid. When I was young, I would sort of sit in my bedroom and create a world of my own, which really started with my love of music. I would just sit in my bedroom with a guitar and a Beatles songbook like all day long and set up pillows in the configuration of a drum set and play along to my favorite records and things like that. Like I had posters of these rock stars on my walls. I never imagined that I would become a poster on a wall, but I really loved, you know, this fantasy of rock and roll. And as much as I wanted it to be a reality, it just seemed inaccessible. But, you know, when I look back at my childhood, I'm really thankful, grateful for everything that I had.
There's a moment when you're trying to teach yourself to play drums and you start off with the bass and snare and you're going boom, tick, boom, tick, boom, tick. And that's, anyone can do that. But then your right hand crosses over and starts playing the ride. You start playing the, you know, and that's a really, really properly thrilling moment. Do you remember that moment and how good it felt, Dave?
Well, I actually remember the first time I sat down at a drum set. It was my cousin Chuck. He lived in Miami, Florida. We went down there for a family trip, and he had a drum set. I mean, this thing was a drum set. And I sat down, and the first thing I did was play the theme to this famous cartoon called George of the Jungle.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It goes dum 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 dum. Exactly. And so I was like, "Wow, I can play the drums. I'm a drummer." You know? But yeah, it really, you know, I don't know why. I mean, I think both of my parents were also musicians. My father was a classically trained flautist. My mother sang in an a cappella group in the 50s. Nothing serious. Neither of them were like professionals, but they did have the ear where you can hear something and you can determine or decipher a pitch or a tempo or tone. And so when I would listen to records, I could figure out those things. So it was just a matter of the physicality of making your fingers do the certain thing on the fretboard or making your arms and hands do a certain thing on the drum set. It was really about coordination. But then, you know, it got to the point where I didn't really have to think too much about playing the drums. I could just kind of do it. It's like dancing. You know, when you get out on the dance floor, you don't really want to be that guy that's thinking about what he's doing while dancing. You just want to like let it out. Yeah. You know, you want to let it go. And that's the way it is with me for drums. I really do think that the DNA has something to do with it. I think that my parents handed down this something in my DNA zipper that I can decipher sound when I hear it.
One of your big influences, you write, was the drummer from Rush, Neil Peart. And, you know, he was probably they were all like, you know, super advanced, accomplished prog rock musicians, but he was the strongest musician in a very strong band there. You write that you used to play his riffs, his drum riffs with your teeth. How did that work?
You know, I don't know how I figured this out. I don't know. I just started kind of like playing along to albums with my teeth, like my jaw kind of grinding back and forth. And I mean, I almost thought, well, everybody must play drums with their teeth. I mean, if I'm doing it, like I can't be the first person to ever do this. And I remember going to the dentist once when I was maybe 10 or 11 years old. And as he was inspecting my mouth, he says, "Do you chew a lot of ice?" And I said, I don't think so. And he said, "Because your teeth have an unusual amount of deterioration." And it clicked. I was like, "Oh my God, I can play drums with my teeth." And I made him put his ear near my mouth and I like played a Rush song. And he was just like, "Get the hell out of my office right now. Get out."
And Kurt Cobain was the only other guy you met who did this too. He could do that with his teeth as well. Wow.
Yeah, well, you know, now since writing the book, I've heard from a lot of musicians that they kind of do the same thing. So I thought that I was the weirdest person in the world because I could, you know, play 2112 with my mouth. But apparently, a lot of musicians do it. So every person has their own internal meter or internal clock, the way that they play. I mean, it's, you know, it's what musicians call feel. It's not something that you can learn. And each person's feel is a little bit different. I think that it has to do with some sort of internal rhythm. And, you know, that comes out in your playing and your teeth.
I've got a theory about drummers and punk music. I mean, because you're a fan of Neil Peart, and so was actually David Lovering in the Pixies. He was a big fan of his as well. I wonder if the punk bands that really cut through are the ones who have drummers who can play like you, like him, and like David Lovering, this absolutely hard but super, super tight style of drumming that keeps the band all on the same page. You sort of gather up the whole band with that kind of style of drumming, and that gives the guitarist a lot of freedom to be much looser and slightly out of time and to bob and weave around it. I don't know. What do you think of that theory, Dave?
Well, you know, one of the reasons why I fell in love with Rush was it was the first time I listened to a band where the drums were in the forefront. It was almost like the drums were in the spotlight. And I think the reason why they were is because his drumming was so musical. I mean, the way his parts and the things that he would play, it was lyrical, you know, and his drumming was songwriting in itself. The composition of what he was playing was as important as any one of the guitar riffs or vocal melodies in every song. The flip side to that is a drummer that is just there in the engine room to lay down the backbeat, to lay it down just to push the song forward. You know, I can appreciate both things. My favorite drummer of all time is the drummer of Led Zeppelin, John Bonham. And I think that he was both of those things. You know, if you listen to a song like Kashmir by Led Zeppelin, I mean, that is a very, very straight ahead, meat and potatoes backbeat. But the thing about it, it's his feel. It's the where he lands his snare and where he lands his kick drum. And it's almost like his internal rhythm. And that's the thing. I think as a drummer, what you want is to have your signature sound so that if you say you play someone 15 seconds of a drummer, if they know who that drummer is in those 15 seconds, then I think you've achieved success because your instrument should be your voice. But, you know, within the punk rock scene, most of the drummers' albums that I grew up listening to and loving were self-taught, you know, and full of, like, bad habits and really, like, rough around the edges. But I loved that. You know, I loved that it wasn't perfect. I loved that it was raw. And there's something about that, the human element of that really, really excited me. And so, yeah, you put all those three things together and sit down at a drum set and make a bunch of noise. That's basically what I did for the rest of my life.
So when you were little, you were listening to a lot of Led Zeppelin and AC/DC and bands like that. But tell me how you were introduced to punk rock by your cousin Tracy at the age of 13.
Yeah, so my mother was in the singing group in the 50s called the Three Bells. And one of the people in the band was her best friend, Sherry. We called her Aunt Sherry, though we're not technically blood relatives. We just grew up with Sherry and her family. They lived in Chicago. So every summer we would drive from Springfield, Virginia to Chicago, Illinois. It's about a 12-hour drive. And we would make that drive. Seeing Chicago in the distance, it was like the Emerald City, you know, like the huge Sears Tower. And every year I thought, oh my God, what adventure lies ahead this year? Well, I had four cousins, Trip, Todd, Troy, and Tracy.
Right? Wow.
If that's not the most American thing you've ever heard in your life. And so, but Tracy was maybe 2 years older than me. She was like me. She was like an adventurous, hyperactive, mischievous kid. And this one year we drove up there, Aunt Sherry greets us at the door and she says, Tracy, they're here. And I could hear her coming down the stairs. It was like, douche, douche, douche. And it just sounded like chains and leather and, you know, boots. And she comes to the bottom of the stairs and she was a punk rocker. And I had never seen a punk rocker in real life. I'd only seen it on TV shows like Chips and Quincy and things like that. I didn't know that this was real. And she took me upstairs to her bedroom and she started playing me these punk rock records. And I had never heard of any of these bands. I had never heard of any of these record labels. All of these records seemed homemade. You know, they were like 7-inch singles stuffed into a sleeve with like a Xerox copied cover and things like that. And I was so blown away, mostly at the independence of all of it. You know, you didn't need to be that poster on your wall. You didn't need like the lasers and the dragons and the explosions and the castles and whatever. It was like, these people were doing it themselves. And because I was kind of a, you know, imaginative active kid, I immediately decided, oh, I want to, this is what I want to do. I mean, this band only knows three chords. I only know three chords. Like, I could do this as well. And then she took me to a show that night, a band from Chicago called Naked Raygun. Again, I imagine rock and roll to be those lasers and the dragons and the castles and the wizards and stuff. And I walk into this tiny room that's just like brick walls with a small stage and a couple lights. And the band kicked into a song. The room absolutely exploded. And my chest was against the stage. And the singer was like stepping on my head. And there was spit, blood, puke. And I was like, this is amazing. You know, it changed my life. That was the first day of the rest of my life. And I went home and decided, okay, I'm going to do this all by myself. So I did.
You mentioned there that you listened really closely to John Bonham, the drummer from Led Zeppelin. And that's the seance you write about in your book, this ritual you embarked upon, where you asked John Bonham for all sorts of things. Tell me how that unfolded and how you did that, Dave.
Well, you know, at the time, I was, I think, maybe 16 or 17 years old. And I started thinking about the concept of feel, what it is that makes a drummer great, what it is that gives a drummer their signature sound. I mean, it makes no sense to like over intellectualize it. It just is what it is. And I think it's given to you by the universe, like a fingerprint, you know? So at the time I was listening to a lot of Led Zeppelin and a lot of other sort of fringe underground music. I was also experimenting with psychedelics. So, you know, I wasn't raised in a religious household. I was sent to Catholic school for 2 years just for reform, really, where I did study religion and I did study the Bible and had classes like Old Testament, New Testament, Christian scriptures, and this one class called Understanding Your Faith, which I really liked, trying to explain the concept of faith, you know, an unconditional belief in something that defies reason. Well, that's what I was most interested in. So I basically made this altar. I got like a piece of plywood from my laundry room and I drew these insignias and things and like lit a candle and basically sat in front of this thing and meditated and like, you know, subpoenaed the universe for this power to become a musician. You know, I don't know who I was praying to. I don't know exactly what I was praying for, but I, in a strange way, which I realize now, I was basically trying to manifest this dream of mine. And you know what? I forgot about it for years. I just forgot that I'd even done such a crazy thing. And when I look back now, I'm like, okay, first of all, it worked. Second of all,
yeah.
I sure hope I didn't sell my soul to someone that I don't know.
That's right. You stood on a crossroads like Robert Johnson and I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
To the devil. No, maybe what you're asking, you ask the universe for this. You know, you ask the universe to grant you this life that you so badly want, this creative rock and roll life. But I think maybe what you're really asking, the forces you're really enlisting are your subconscious mind to work in unison with your conscious mind and help you write the songs, direct you, and sort of work in that kind of unified manner. I don't know. What do you think about that, Dave?
Well, I do believe in the idea that if you can perceive it, you can achieve it. You know, as I was writing the book, I knew nothing about the law of attraction. I knew nothing about manifestation. I knew nothing about that Oprah book, The Secret. Like, I didn't know about any of this stuff. And so as I was kind of doing a little bit of research, writing about this seance that I had, I realized that I was putting that out there. I was trying to make it happen only in that I would believe it was possible. And when I was young, I really did think I could do anything. Even when I was, you know, 9 or 10 years old, I thought if I really put my mind to it, I can do whatever I want.
Where do you think that came from, that rock solid belief?
I think it came from my mother. I mean, my mother, being a public school teacher for 35 years, you know, she had a great understanding of how a child's mind works. And, you know, unfortunately, when you're born, when you're young, your imagination just runs wild because you haven't built those parameters or those walls around your imagination in what is and what isn't possible. So I think it started with my mother. She was very encouraging and supportive in anything that I wanted to do, especially music. I think it probably comes from there. But also, you know, you have to have some sort of faith in yourself, some sort of confidence or some sort of courage to at least try, just at least try to do the thing that you're not sure you can do. And I've kind of used that as my divining rod my entire life. I'm not sure if I could do this. That's why I'm going to do it. That's why I started the Foo Fighters. I'm not sure if I can do this. That's why I wrote a book. That's why I directed documentaries. I'm not sure if I can do this. I have to sort of prove to myself that I can. And that usually is what sort of pushes me forward.
So you started some local punk bands with your friends and then joined another local punk band called Scream, who'd been your heroes. They're a bit older than you, but they brought you in as drummer and you went on tour around the United States with them. Tell me about that tour and that experience of going around America in a van like that with those guys.
Well, you know, coming from like a very simple household where we didn't have much, but we had enough and we were happy. You know, it wasn't like winning American Idol. You know, it wasn't like being on The Voice where all of a sudden you're scooped up and thrown onto an airplane and playing stadiums all over the world. You know, it was six guys in a van and we were playing these small clubs and squats and community centers, hoping that enough people would come so that we'd have money to get gas to go to the next show. We never had hotels. We would sleep in the van or sleep on someone's floor or sleep on the stage that we just performed on, things like that. And it was okay, you know, because at the end of the day, you were playing music. Music brought you there. And that's what we needed to survive, more so than, you know, than food. It was like, okay, well, we're going to play a show tonight. And that's what kind of keeps you going. And so at 18 years old, you know, standing with my feet in the sand, looking out at the Pacific Ocean, like I had crossed the entire country just playing music. That to me was my life's greatest achievement at that point. I didn't know how I was going to get home, but, you know, I felt like, okay, music brought me here. The love of my life, music, got me so that I'm looking out at the Pacific Ocean. You know, there's like nude yoga going on and hippie drum circles or whatever. But I was like, I made it here. This is amazing. And yeah, I think that, you know, you kind of forgive all of the, you know, the struggle that you would go through every single day because you were free and it was music that brought you there. And so, you know, those early experiences, they really do lay some sort of foundation which you rely upon for the rest of your life, to be grateful for things or to be thankful for whatever you have. You know, if I walk into a bar or walk into a backstage and I look and there's, you know, there's six free beers in a bucket, I'm like, yay, free beer. You know what I mean? Like it becomes your foundation. And I'm really, really thankful I got to do that stuff.
It's a weird life. It's like a mix of an almost monastic life because you're living on in sort of like happy poverty, if that's the word for it, self-induced poverty. But then there's all this headbanging wildness going on in the course of the evening. So it's a sort of a mix of the two. Is there a freedom in not being afraid of that freedom in a funny sort of way and not being afraid of the poverty that comes along with that life with a touring punk band?
Yeah. I mean, you know, our expectations were just that we would be able to strap on our instruments at the end of every night and play. You know, back then also, there wasn't really any sort of career ambition because of the type of music we were playing. It's not like Scream was going to knock Mariah Carey off the charts. You know what I mean? It was like, we did it because we loved to do it. But it was okay. I mean, I never wanted to go home. I never wanted to quit. I never called home and asked for money for a bus ticket. I just never did it. That never even entered my mind. You know, I think that also I didn't really have much to go back to. You know, like if I went back to Virginia, I'd just get my job at the furniture warehouse again and beg my boss for my job back and then work that until it was time to leave on another trip. So it really was the thing that kept me going, you know, and what it is that you need to survive. Like, is it food? Is it happiness? Is it music? What is it? In my case, more than anything, it was the freedom to play music. And that's how I felt in those years in the van, you know.
So Scream broke up and you were sort of stranded in Los Angeles for a while, living really in dire poverty where you just weren't even sure where you, your next meal was coming from. And then you heard that a Seattle band named Nirvana was looking for a drummer. Now, they'd released their first album, Bleach, at that point. But what did you know of them at that point, Dave?
Oh, yeah. The Bleach album was really popular in the underground. And I mean, that being said, that meant like maybe, you know, they sold 20,000 copies or 30,000 copies or something. But, you know, Nirvana really stood out from all the other bands in the scene. They were kind of like a punk rock band, but sort of like a heavier, like not metal band, but it was like really, it's eventually what people called grunge. But at the time it was like, you know, they had this sound that was just different than everyone else. And I mean, they had songs. That was the thing. That that song About a Girl is in the middle of that album, Bleach, an album filled with like huge guitars and huge drums and dissonant, crazy, noisy distortion. And then right in the middle is this song called About a Girl that sounds like it could have been a Lennon-McCartney composition. And you think, oh my God, wait, they have songs. So they were popular in the underground, you know, and I loved that record. And we had a mutual friend. So when we were stuck in Los Angeles, I called my friend, who was also in a band, and said, hey, we're still here. The band's not happening right now. So if you come to Los Angeles, let's hang out. And that's when my friend said, well, have you heard of Nirvana? And I said, of course. And he said, they're looking for a drummer. And they had just come to a Scream show maybe a few weeks before. And I think they saw the way that I played the drums and said, you know, if we can get a guy like that, we'd be good to go. And so he gave me Chris Novoselic's phone number and I called him. And we had a great conversation. Actually, I called him and he said, well, we already got a drummer. And I said, oh, okay. Well, if you come down to LA, I'm stuck in a house full of mud wrestlers. Just come hang out, and, you know, whatever.
And you're not exaggerating. You were actually stuck in a house of mud wrestlers at the time. That's right.
We were. I mean, when I say stuck, yeah, the singer and the guitar player of our band Scream were brothers. And their sister was a mud wrestler at the Hollywood Tropicana. And so we always had a place to stay. And it could be worse, right? So
no food, but interesting
so, anyway,
company.
So, yeah. So I talked to Novoselic, and then he said, you know, you should call Kurt. And then Kurt and I talked, and he said, well, if you can, come on up to Seattle, and let's jam. And so I did.
So you moved in with Kurt Cobain in his little house in Olympia, just outside of Seattle. He had the bedroom, you write, while you had the couch in the living room. Tell me about your roommate in the terrarium next to your couch.
Oh, God, that turtle. Listen, I am an animal lover, but damn that turtle, man. That thing every night would just, like, bang its head against the glass as I'm trying to sleep on the couch, and it was just like, boom, 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 all night long, boom, boom, boom. And, most people would like go running and screaming with their tail between their legs for the bus station to go home. But at the end of every day, me and Chris and Kurt would go to this like barn where we rehearsed and we would write and play. And I mean, we practiced like every day. And that's what kept me from losing my mind, really.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler, podcast, broadcast, and online.
I remember an interview, and I don't know where I read this, but from at the time when Nirvana were happening, and Kurt Cobain said he wanted to make an album. He wanted Nevermind to be an album like Back in Black, AC/DC's Back in Black, where every song on it was a killer. Not just with like three, maybe four possible hit songs on it with a bunch of filler, but every song was going to be amazing. How ambitious was he at that stage to be in a big band? Was he, because there was that whole ethos of punk rock at the time, which is like, you want to be successful, but you don't want to look too successful. And if you're successful, you're going to get accused of being sold out. There's a whole lot of tension that goes into that, isn't there, Dave?
Yeah. I mean, I think that Kurt was very ambitious. I mean, he was also very prolific. So we were writing new songs almost every day. They were coming in so quickly. And every night after rehearsal, we'd go back to the apartment. He'd go in his room. He would write in his journals. He would work on lyrics. You know, I think more than anything, he just wanted us to be a great band. You know, he put a lot of attention and focus on his songwriting. And I mean, there was one time when we were going around and talking to record companies, sitting in this high-rise office building with the head of a huge record company, sitting behind this big oak desk. And he said, okay, what do you guys want? And Kurt said, we want to be the biggest band in the world. And I thought he was kidding. Like, seriously, I thought, like, that was funny. You know, that was a good one. Like, there's no way that we would ever become the biggest band in the world. But I do think, you know, as a songwriter, you know, I can't speak for him. I always looked at it like he wanted to be appreciated as a songwriter, like the songwriters that he loved. And when we first started touring for that record, it was back of the van and it was the small clubs and loading the gear on stage and stuff. I don't think anybody really expected the band to wind up going in places that we went. I didn't think anyone thought we were going to be a huge band, but we did work, and we worked for a reason, because we wanted to be good. We wanted to be a good band. We wanted to play good shows. And it is difficult when you're raised in that kind of ethically suffocating punk rock scene where you're conditioned to reject conformity and any sort of corporate influence. You know, when we signed to a major label, we were basically following in the footsteps of our heroes, Sonic Youth, a band that, you know, was a legendary band of integrity. We thought, okay, well, if they signed to this label, then that's a safe place. We can do that. But then, you know, once you start selling millions of records and millions of people start singing your songs, you wind up in this conflicted place where you're no longer one of us in the underground, you're one of them in the mainstream. And it can be really challenging. It can be really difficult to navigate that and try to justify it or come to terms with it. I think Nirvana really struggled with that. Although, you know, to me, I look at it like, you know what our biggest problem was? Kurt's songs were so good that millions of people wanted to sing along.
I remember when I saw the film clip to Smells Like Teen Spirit for the first time. And I don't know if this is hindsight, intruding on this, but it felt at that time you were killing off the era of big hair metal bands had just gone on for far too long. It'd become too ridiculous. It sort of burnt out like glam rock. And then suddenly there's these three guys who actually look like their audience. You know, you're not dressed up. I mean, Kurt's wearing a cardigan in a lot of those film clips, and it smells like Teen Spirit. You know, you look like normal. You look like, you know, the people we knew at the time. Do you remember where you were when you saw that go on MTV for the first time, Dave, the film clip of Smells Like Teen Spirit?
I do, actually. We were on tour in Pennsylvania, and Kurt and I used to share a room. I could picture the room in my mind as I'm talking about it right now. So there were these two twin beds, and there was a TV in the corner, this old television. And we knew that the video was going to be on that night. I think it was like a Sunday night. There was some show on MTV. I think it was 120 minutes, where they showed all the kind of college rock or alternative bands. And we just sat there waiting for it to come on. And it was like, okay, there's a Morrissey video. And then there's a Cure video. And then there's a Husker Du video. And then they're like, up next, the new video by Nirvana. And I mean, it was strange. It just seemed surreal to see yourself on television. Mm-hmm. I don't think it really sunk in for a while. But I do remember like everyone picking up the phone, calling room to room. Like, it's on, the video's on. It was exciting. You know, and we were young. I mean, 21 or 22 years old. It was a real thrill. That was a real first, and it felt good.
Then, of course, once you become that successful, and there's this whole new audience coming to your shows, some of those guys in the crowd, you're right, were those football buff heads who'd been just hideous in high school, you know, who'd beaten you up or Kurt up, and there they are, getting right into your music. How much did you hate that, Dave?
Well, you know, it's funny. As I've grown older and have had a lot of time to think about this, like now when the Foo Fighters play, we'll play a stadium and it holds 50 or 60,000 people. And I look out at the audience and I don't expect everyone to agree with each other on everything. I look out and I see different walks of life and different races and different religions, but everyone comes together in that moment to sing the chorus of a song. So if it's My Hero or Best of You or Everlong, whatever it is, seeing that many people come together and sing in chorus, to me, it's beautiful because there are so few things in life that will unify people from different walks of life like music can. With Nirvana, when we went from being in the underground scene to becoming this mainstream band, and I don't want to say that like we turned into a mainstream band, they just put our band into the mainstream. You know, you can look at it one or two ways. You can either look at your audience and say, I don't want you. Or you can have some sort of hope that maybe you'll open their mind. Maybe your message or your lyrics or your songs can open up a new sensitivity or understanding in someone that might not have that otherwise. So it really is an opportunity to not only bring people together, but maybe change them. Maybe in the lyrics that you write, they'll find a new understanding of themselves. So it's a hard one to figure out. It's a tough nut to crack. But I'm more of a hopeful person in that, like, I hope that my music brings some sort of like hope and joy and positivity into someone's life. You know,
I remember you came to Australia on tour in early 1992, just as that giant kind of rocket explosion underneath you was happening, just as Nirvana was really coming into the air, and you were booked into plenty of small to medium-sized venues around Australia while you were rapidly on your way to becoming the biggest band in the world. What's your memory of that tour in Australia at the time? Were we nice, Dave, or were we terrifying at the time?
Oh, no, it was, I mean, you have to understand, that trip, we did a 6 or 7 week tour of America. It was so, I mean, it was like 6 days on, one day off, 6 days on, one day off. Then we had one day off and went to Europe and did 6 days on, one day off, six for another 6 weeks. Came home from that and we were just broken, man. We were so exhausted. And then our next trip was Australia and Japan. It seemed like going to another planet. It seemed like, it just seemed so totally unbelievable that, again, music would take us to a place that's halfway around the world. And I remember I fell in love with Australia. I mean, most Australians know how much the Foo Fighters love Australia, but that was my first trip down there. And, you know, I thought it was paradise. We made great lifelong friends. We played some really hot shows. And I decided then that it would be somewhere I would want to return to for the rest of my life. But yeah, those shows were nuts, man. I mean, I think we played the first big day out.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just all seemed so, just like a dream. It was happening so quickly. And every day there was something new. And you just thought, God, I can't believe this is happening. This is so weird.
There's a really amazing part in your book where you talk about how a friend invited you over to a house in Los Angeles for a swim. And it happened to be the house that Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate had once lived in, that she had been murdered in. And this is where Nine Inch Nails were recording one of their albums there. And, you know, that sort of brings into focus the scene in the early 90s at the time, which was there was, for all that apparent negativity, there was a lot of positivity around punk initially, you know, the DIY ethos, anti-apathy ideology, anti-sexism, anti-racism and all that. Nine Inch Nails were in a darker place than that kind of positive energy. What did you think about that? And you can love that music but not be that person. Is that what you were thinking as you were watching that scene unfold?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I was a huge fan of Nine Inch Nails.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I love Nine Inch Nails. And I don't think you have to necessarily mirror the aesthetic of the band that you love. But I do think that you listen to that music for a reason. You know, there's something about a band like Nine Inch Nails that you listen to connect with that darker side of yourself, or to maybe help heal it, or just to feel understood. So, yeah, I mean, you know, just as I, when I was a kid, I was like on my bedroom floor listening to Beatles records, and like there's a lot of them, are, they're sunny and they're beautiful and they're fun. But at the same time, you know, I could turn around and listen to like some crazy like black metal record that was just like dissonant doom. And I connected to that in some way too. But also, I think with songwriting, if it's coming from a real place, then there is this purity and honesty in what you do. And I think with Trent, Trent's brilliant and he's a great guy. I've gotten to record with him and he's awesome. But I do think his personality comes out in that music. And I'm sure that he needs that music to, you know, maybe heal or soothe that part of him that feels the pain or the darkness, whatever it is. But I mean, basically that summer, I was down here visiting friends in Los Angeles, and I was staying in my friend's house that had no air conditioning in the San Fernando Valley. So by 10 o'clock in the morning, every day it was 110 degrees or something like that. So we would basically go looking for people who had swimming pools and just to use their pool for the day to cool off. And this friend of mine said, "Hey, guess where we're swimming today?" I said, "Where?" He said, "The house where Sharon Tate was killed by the Manson family." And to be honest, I felt really weird about it. And I remember going there and immediately feeling that it was a bit too dark for me. So we swam and got the hell out of there as fast as we could.
You write how when you discovered indirectly that Kurt Cobain had been using heroin, how distressed you were and bewildered you were by his need to take it. And after he took his own life in April 1994, you thought about leaving music altogether. Why did you feel like leaving music altogether after that?
Well, I mean, you know, when the band ended and Kurt died, it was traumatic. You know, it was really difficult. I mean, our whole world was just turned upside down. And, you know, my relationship with Nirvana was musical. And so when that was sort of like taken away, it was hard for me to listen to any music. And that was the first time in my life I'd ever felt like that. You know, I put the instruments away and I turned the radio off because it just kind of hurt too much to listen to someone else sing about their joy or their pain. And I was lost, you know, I was kind of numb. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to sit back down on a drum stool because I would always imagine Kurt and Chris standing in front of me. And I was afraid of getting stuck in that kind of quicksand, you know? So I kind of took a soul searching trip and eventually realized that music was the thing that was going to heal me, as it always had. And that I needed to go home and get back to work. So I started the Foo Fighters.
Yeah. You'd already been writing songs just quietly on the side. And you recorded a song called Color Pictures of a Marigold that got turned into a Nirvana song. But I really like the original version, that sort of cassette version that's sort of floating around on YouTube. It's a beautiful song. When you start to write a song, when you're building it up from scratch, Dave, where do you start? Do you start with a lyric or is there a riff? And then how do the other components of the song come in? And I'm asking that because I know on that first Foo Fighters album, you played all the instruments and layered them one on top of another. How do you like to build up a song when you're doing that?
Well, it kind of depends. I mean, they're all sort of different. Sometimes they start with a lyric. Sometimes they start with a melody. Sometimes they start with a rhythm. It's just a matter of letting it happen when it's time for it to happen, you know.
And is that in your ear before you sit down with the guitar, or is it, do you sit down with the guitar and then it comes up?
Well, you know, fortunately, I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, I never really took lessons to play. So most of the chords and the things that I'm playing, I don't even know what they're called. I know the basic chords, but I try to come up with interesting melodies and arrangements and guitar riffs just to be innovative. Like when I sit down with the guitar, I'll just let my hand land somewhere and start playing along. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think because I don't know what's right or wrong in sound or in songwriting, that there is no right and wrong. So it's just kind of anything goes, you know. But I've always enjoyed recording things by myself, as I did, like even before I was in Nirvana, I would record these songs by myself. I played drums and bass guitar and put a vocal on it, but really just as an experiment. And I barely let anybody hear them. And then, you know, eventually I thought, all right, well, I'm going to do this for real in a real studio. There are times where I'll be driving and I'll start coming up with a melody and I'll start coming up with a lyric and I can't reach down to get my phone to record it, or I can't, you know, and so I'll basically just keep singing it. And so I walk into the house, I'm still singing it down the hallway, still singing it upstairs, still singing it as I'm in front of my computer, still singing it as I'm setting it, and then I'll record it.
Yeah. These days, you're good friends with Paul McCartney, and there's some similarities there in spite of the obvious differences. You're both men who were in game-changing bands that survived the experience and went on to have very successful bands afterwards, and a family life with that. Is he your role model in that way, Dave?
God, that's a good question. No one's really asked me that. I mean, there's so much to love about him. Of course, you know, as a Beatle, he's changed the world and, you know, made our lives a much more beautiful place with his music. As a person, he really is such a great guy. I know that sounds funny to say, but he, you know, I think he has a good understanding of who he is and what he represents to others. And more than anything, I think that, you know, he just wants to be a human being and play music and spread the joy and spread the love. You know, when I look at him, the one thing that I really look up to the most is his energy and his passion and joy for playing music. I mean, like, you know, he'll do an hour and a half long sound check and he'll walk off stage, have something to eat, get up on stage for 3.5 hours, play songs that change the world, walk off stage, you know, and then hang out and be the last one on the dance floor every night. It's unbelievable. Wow. I'm telling you, man, this guy, like, he's, and beyond that, like, he really is such a sweet friend. And it's funny when that comes out of my mouth, it's just so hard to imagine it's true,
but I'm sure
he really is. I mean, he's a good friend. It's cool.
Tell me about that music lesson he gave your daughter one day when he came around. Yeah.
Well, my daughter Ophelia was born, and I don't know, maybe a week or so later, Paul and Nancy were in town and they said, hey, we want to come see the new baby. So they came over and, you know, we're like having some pizza and drinking some wine. And then it was time for them to leave. And as Paul was walking out, he saw the piano in the living room and he just sat down and started playing Lady Madonna. And, you know, it just blows your mind. It's happening right there in your living room. But my daughter, Harper, who I think was maybe 4 or 5 years old at the time, she went into the kitchen and grabbed a coffee mug, put some change in it, and put it on top of the piano like a tip jar.
Because he needs the money, you know. He needs a bit of bit of encouragement.
We thought it was so funny. And then she sat down next to him at the piano, and he showed her how to play. And the two of them kind of sat and wrote a song together. And it was unbelievable. I mean, full circle moments, they don't get any better than that.
Did your daughter learn the lesson?
She did. You know, the next morning I woke up and I heard her playing that same melody in the living room. So, yeah. And then she became a drummer.
Really? What did you say when she said, Dad, I want to be a drummer? You say, are you crazy? Go to college, you know, get an education.
No, I was like, first of all, that's like, that is an entry level, like, mailroom position. Are you sure that's where you want to start? And I had never took lessons to play the drums, so I didn't know how to give them. So I sat her down, told her, okay, your right foot goes here, left foot goes here, the stick goes here, do this, this, this. And I got her to the point where she was kind of playing that backbeat. And then I said, actually, you know what? Hold on. And I went and I got AC/DC's Back in Black. And I said, this is all you need. And she sat and learned to play by listening to AC/DC.
Wow. That's fantastic. There's a moment in your book where you write about when you were in Chicago playing at a baseball stadium, Chicago's Wrigley Field Stadium. And after the gig, you just burst into tears. Can you explain why you were feeling so emotional that night?
Well, you know, I think that night, it was emotional for more than a few reasons. One, it was my mother's birthday. Two, I had a broken leg and I'd been on tour for 65 shows in this ridiculous throne contraption with my, I couldn't even walk. I mean, the people would basically like pick me up, put me in the throne. I'd play for 2.5 hours, then they'd pick me up and carry me backstage for months. I mean, it was 3 or 4 months of that. But also playing this stadium right across the street from where I saw my first concert, that little corner bar called the Cubby Bear, was literally a crosswalk away from this stadium that we were now headlining. And I think it all just kind of hit me because, you know, I never imagined that I would be here. And all of the people that helped kind of carry me across that crosswalk from one side of the street to the other, my mother, my friends, my band members, the audience, it all kind of like hit me in that moment. And I was just very grateful, you know. And then I went backstage and sat in a chair for another 6 hours.
So it was like you went all the way around the world to cross the street.
Yeah, you know, that was actually a revelation I made while writing the book, where I kind of, you know, it was like a metaphorical journey from one side of the street to the next. We'd all crossed the street together. And it kind of all pulled it together full circle right there.
The ghost of John Bonham has some seriously magical powers, Dave. Congratulations. It's been lovely talking with you, and congratulations on your book. Thank you so much for spending the time to talk today.
Thanks for having me. I can't wait to come down and see you guys.
Dave Grohl's memoir is called The Storyteller.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.